So yeah, I think the 90s was a really special era because they are the beneficiaries of Jordan and they buy sneakers, right? Like that's when the contracts, the first $100 million contract, Juwan Howard, happens in the 90s, right? So I think it's the 90s, maybe it might be 2000, but that's when the money started getting generational, right? When the wealth that these guys were earning was generational wealth. And so obviously it also gave them more power. And then the NBA has the benefit of having those guaranteed contracts. Whereas if you're in football, you get that big one, they might get rid of you next year, right? So I think there's a little, and even if you think about that in terms of what the players can do socially, like Kaepernick, black ball out of the NFL, right? No more contract from him. But the NBA is more lenient with their players in terms of their activism, but then also those contracts are guaranteed. So I think it also emboldens them to be more active and to assert themselves in a way that other leagues or the players in other leagues don't do.
This is the Bruce Poinsett Show. This is the Bruce Poinsett Show. For the world's most dangerous infomercial, I'm your host, Bruce Poinsett. Along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. This is the best of the Bruce Poinsett Show, the world's most dangerous infomercial. I'm your host, Bruce Poinsett, and along with my producer, Ada, we bring you this weekly commentary and interview experience from the Numbers FM studio at the Portland Art Museum. You can catch the full show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. You can also catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett, plus exclusive bonus content on patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. Make sure to follow us on twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM, that's numbers with a Z, or the Numbers Podcast Network on thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z, or wherever you get your podcasts. So, Mitchell, thank you for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, man. I've been moving around. I was in Portland. I was home Friday, then LA Saturday, and then New York Sunday, and South Carolina, and now I'm back in Phoenix. So I'm a little road weary, but I'm also thankful to be home and talking to you.
I always appreciate the time, and yeah, I can only imagine. You know, you've got a bunch of other assignments, but also you got a new book out.
Yeah.
Fly, the big book of basketball fashion.
That's right.
Yeah. And I love the concept for this. Like my mom's favorite player back in the day was Walt Frazier. And anyone listening to this, watching this, they know Walt Clyde Frazier. They know he was like the fashion icon.
Absolutely.
Of the NBA back in the 70s.
Yeah.
But yeah, can you just talk a little bit about like what can readers expect? It's not just, you got essays, but you also got like, it's also like a photo. Photo book. So yeah, can you just talk about what can readers expect with Fly?
Well, it started off as when they, so I should go back to the genesis of this book. The publisher's husband is a basketball fan. And Leah, and he brought the idea to her, who then through another mutual friend brought it to me. And they knew that I liked fashion and I liked basketball, probably in that order. It seemed like a kind of natural fit. And they pitched it to me as a photo book with like very little writing in it. They were like, oh, it's, you know, it'll be like the length of one of your articles. So initially it was more, and it still is more photo heavy, but the concept of the essays and defining the style through different eras, that came later.
Yeah. And with just being like a fashion enthusiast, a basketball enthusiast.
Yeah.
I got asked locally, you know, guy player Jeremy Grant just signed an extension.
Man.
I gotta get your assessment on Jeremy. Just
listen, man. If anybody is hearing this, put me in contact with Jeremy Grant. Before he just won, like, I don't know what the exact award name was, but something like newcomer of the year or sleeper of the year from NBA League Pitch, which is probably one of the premier sites where the players' art fashion is reposted and, you know, really got this going. And I saw him months and months and months ago because I wasn't keeping up with the Blazers as much as I should because I'm in Phoenix and they're still my team, but I had another team to kind of keep track of too. So when I saw Jeremy, I actually think I saw him, it was at a Phoenix game, and maybe that's why. And he had on some Margiela, which is one of my favorite brands. And I was like, oh, this dude knows what he's doing. And then I started following him on Instagram, and I'm like, oh, no, he really knows what he's doing. And now he's one of my favorite players as far as NBA style, without doubt.
Yeah, no, I'm just, yeah, as a Blazer fan, I'm thrilled. Obviously, I'm not as much of a fashion enthusiast, but just having him here, like, it, you know, it's unmistakable.
Yeah. I really, really like his style. He's really carving out. It doesn't look like the other players. It's kind of bohemian chic in a way, the brands that he wears. I love his jewelry. It's very tasteful. Like, he does a lot of really great things. And now he got that big contract. Like, I can only imagine. Maybe he'll start his own brand now. Who knows?
Yeah. And one of the, you know, themes you talk about with this book beyond just fashion is just like the platform that NBA players have, like, both is just with the fashion, then also just with let me pull it up, because I feel like you worded it best. And now to today, a time defined not only by social media and high fashion's birthing of the tunnel walk, but one in which athletes are idealized as style icons and activists, figures who inspire conversations beyond how they play and what they wear.
Yeah.
And that thought just really resonated with me, because I think it's something I think about all the time, especially, you know, post 2020.
Yeah.
But you just talk a little bit more about that space that athletes hold with, again, being high profile public figures with this platform, with this space to reach especially young people.
Yeah. I want to take it back to the Cleveland Summit. Not sure the exact year. I want to say it's maybe 1964. And there are some iconic photos from that. So first of all, something that I think Jim Brown, he got all of the kind of top athletes at the time to come there. And it was about civil rights. And it was Kareem was there. Obviously, Jim Brown was there. I think Bill Russell was also there. And if you look at photos of them, I mean, they're all in really nice tailored suits and they're laughing and smiling. And so, I mean, if you think about what would have happened if the Cleveland Summit, I mean, there was big press on it too, but what would have happened if the Cleveland Summit had social media? Like, how much would that have resonated? Because those guys were also, like, you know, Bill Russell, Will Chamberlain, certainly, Jim Brown, all of those dudes were really fashionable players. And so I think fashion and activism has always been a part of sports. And I think the players maybe kind of, I would say in the 80s when we, you know, Reaganomics and money, money, money and capitalism kind of pushed us away. Remember the quote that Jordan had, like, even Republicans buy sneakers. So that was the era where the politics of sports was less explicit. And I think, you know, now what we're seeing is players have more awareness, right? Like, social media has not only given them a platform to become brands, but it's also given them more awareness. Like, they can go through their feed and see, you know, basically what's happening. And you can, if you're interested, you can also obviously click and get more into the headlines and the stories. But we got a combination of more awareness of a bigger platform for athletes and more money and power, right? Like, I don't know if you were watching the free agency, it seemed like the NBA was like, they could not wait to give away exorbitant amounts of money. Like, it was almost like, we want to give you 100 million, just like, give us 6 points a game so we can justify giving you $100 million. And I'm exaggerating a little bit, but like, that kind of economic, I mean, think about what Jaylen Brown claimed he wanted to do after he signed the biggest NBA contract, right? He wants to start a new Black Wall Street. Like, that kind of power in an athlete. And this man just got a contract worth $300 million, to say nothing of the probably $100 million he's already made. So these guys are going to come out having made a $500 million, if not $1 billion, just playing basketball, which is Jim Brown, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, probably even Michael Jordan couldn't even imagine that in just salary.
Yeah. And when you talk about Jaylen Brown, especially, I always think about just the effect, because a lot of young people are watching that. And, that might be their first time hearing about Black Wall Street and kind of getting exposed to that.
Exactly.
And, I think about, because also in the blurb about the book, it talks about just, that the evolution over the years. I mean, we start, so you're talking about like Cleveland Summit through the 70s, through the 80s, Jordan's Republicans buy shoes too.
Yeah.
Just lives in infamy. But, but then there's like talk about the 90s and specifically Allen Iverson and that influence. And I'm just curious, like, as far as you, being a basketball player during that time, like, if that had like an effect on you, just whether it's in, I guess, like, because of like how, I want to say disruptive, but like, there's we know all the pushback AI specifically got, but then just like the players of that time got. And I'm sure it's like, were you kind of like watching, paying attention to that kind of growing up?
Well, I should say specifically, I feel a connection to AI. That AI is absolutely not aware of this, but Damon Stoudamire is one of my really great friends. And Damon played in high school with a guy named Aaron McKinney, two players, Aaron McKinney and DeRay Thurgill. And both of those guys ended up going to Maryland Eastern Shore. And Maryland Eastern Shore was on the schedule for Georgetown, or vice versa. They were on each other's schedule. So they played Iverson. And these are two guys who had played with Damon. So my friend Aaron comes back from college in the summer. And he's like, man, he played against, I was like, man, he played against AI. He's like, yeah. I said, man, well, is he faster than Damon? He was like, yeah. And that was the first person that I had ever heard of being quicker than Damon. So I felt that. And then, because Damon and I think they're one draft class apart, that, because Damon was in the league at that time, that was the time when I was most around the NBA and was hanging out with the guys. And, so I feel a deep connection to those 90s squad. I mean, last weekend I was in Atlanta with Damon, and Rasheed Wallace just popped over to watch the fight with us. And I was like, oh man, I remember them days when these guys were hanging out. It's good to see that they still have a friendship too. I think the 90s was a really special era because they are the beneficiaries of Jordan and they buy sneakers, right? Like, that's when the contracts, the first $100 million contract, Juwan Howard, happens in the 90s, right? So I think it's the 90s, maybe it might be 2000, but that's when the money started getting generational, right? When the wealth that these guys were earning was generational wealth. And so obviously it also gave them more power. And then the NBA has the benefit of having those guaranteed contracts. Whereas if you're in football, you get that big one, they might get rid of you next year, right? So I think there's a little, and even if you think about that in terms of what the players can do socially, like Kaepernick, blackball out of the NFL, right? No more contract from him. But the NBA is more lenient with their players in terms of their activism, but then also those contracts are guaranteed. So I think it also emboldens them to be more active and to assert themselves in a way that other leagues, or the players in other leagues don't do.
Yeah, to that point, I mean, when I think about that 90s team, I think about Damon Stoudamire, Rasheed Wallace.
Yeah.
I also think, like, in Portland especially, that was a moment as far as, like, when you got to see the pushback to athletes having that platform. Because, the Jailblazers nickname and that whole thing, it's infamous. I was watching, I want to say it was, like, DraftKings or Underdog who had Rasheed Wallace and Bonzi Wells on to kind of do an interview just about that era. But again, like, you saw this, a full scale kind of like attack on athletes having that platform. And it's like, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. Cause I also think of Rasheed Wallace in terms of, being pivotal with like stations like 95.5 and like bringing in, honestly, just like more Black culture, acceptance of Black culture on like a mass scale in Portland, I can't divorce those two things. But I'm curious, like,
it's hip hop, man. It's the power of hip hop. I mean, that the 90s, late 90s is the golden era of hip hop, right? Like, that's when Jay-Z broke through, DMX broke through, Eminem was on his way, you know, Nelly broke through. Like, those are the top selling albums. Outkast was popping, the top selling albums in hip hop history, the Fugees, Lauryn Hill. And so that power, right, was an economic power, but more importantly, it was a cultural power. And because those acts were out of the, I mean, they're the neighborhood guys, right? Like, so every rap star has some guy in the neighborhood who also made it to some league. And so we're really talking about the same culture. And I think the NBA was scared of that, much like the rest of, I'll just say, white America. And the guys were hip hop dudes, right? They have that, like, hip hop is born out of this kind of counterculture, brash, we will not be oppressed. And so I feel like that leaked into the league. And, you know, obviously Stern tried to push back against it with the dress code.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, it's always interesting when, you know, you see the pieces kind of like saying, how dare this athlete say this or do this? It's always in that same sentence or very close to it, be like, how dare he say this? He's making X, Y, Z.
Exactly.
But, you know, just asking, like, how dare he do this? He's making this. And I, even with,
like,
the,
like, he's got to be divorced of what's happening in the world because he's reached a certain economic platform. Like, he ain't got no cousins or mama or brother or friends or something that are still struggling or still feeling the effects of systemic oppression. Yeah, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, it's something I see now with, I don't know, I'm curious what the conversation around Damian Lillard is like outside of Oregon, because I feel like I'm in this bubble. But like, I see many of those same people who kind of made a name and really got big on pushing that Jailblazers narrative, same voices are back. Like, yeah, get him out of here. It's time to go. Yeah. And it's funny. It's really funny to watch. But just a quick aside, like, speaking of athletes' platform, like, are people talking? You're talking about, you're in Arizona. Like, is this like a point of conversation?
Yeah, I think the nation is talking about Damian Lillard because I think he's really a watershed moment in the league, because though other guys have forced themselves, you know, like, we got the decision with LeBron, which really started, you know, giving the players this kind of power over their careers. But Dame took it to another level, saying, trade me to this team. And so it's really bad for the league if a player can dictate absolutely where they go. So now if he goes to Miami, it's going to look bad all the way around, because the league is going to be like, hey, man, you got us looking crazy out here, you know, dictating where you go. And, you know, I've been paying attention to Blazers. Dame overstayed not his welcome. He overstayed what was a reasonable amount of time to be here, squandering his top years. And no disrespect, like, I love Portland to the max, but none of those teams were going to make it out of the Western Conference Finals. And if I'm a basketball player, a failed college player, certainly at his level, he recognized they weren't going to the chip. So, yes, yeah, it's just interesting, the timing of it, the big, you know, the huge contracts that they're giving out, because I feel like Dame probably got another max contract in him, which means he's going to make another $300 and $350 million, and then that he's exerting this kind of power so loudly, so brashly. It's almost like a standoff.
Yeah. I mean, admittedly, like, I'm a person, like, holding out in my heart, just like, come on, Joe Cronin, do pull some magic, you know, Danny Ainge with the Celtics in 2008 move and make this work. It's probably not happening. But, you know, it's also, it comes back to, like, the platform of the athletes for me, where, you know, I just think about how much Dame has meant to the city in terms of just, you know, beyond the basketball court, but just being in the community.
Seems like a stand-up guy for sure. I remember watching during the summer of 2020 when he was out there marching with people, and this is before we even knew what COVID would do to you, and he was out there, man, and everything that I've heard about him is that he's a person of really high character, a family man, really down for his community, took care of his people. So all the way around, you know, it's just maybe a little unfortunate that he has to get out of Portland in this way.
Yeah. It's, again, it's, you know, I'll keep crossing my fingers.
Yeah.
Still, trade hasn't happened yet. We can make some miracles. There's still time for a miracle. But I mean, with those, it's like Damian Lillard, I think, is probably the biggest example of recent teams. But I also did a profile of this painter, Otis Cueco, where one of the parts of his story was talking about Al-Farouq Aminu and his wife having like this showcase for early in his career for just to showcase African artists in Portland, that being just a big boost. And it's just one of these things where I'm not sure if a lot of people, you know, obviously, like when we're talking about sports, we're talking about his fans watching and all that. But just like, again, that platform and that ability to broadcast, and not just, you know, for yourself, but also for your community, for people, like it can't be understated. So anytime someone talks about they're making so this much money, it's like, yeah, great. Because there's also a whole discussion about the new labor agreement, and it's kind of capping out mid-level and like other players on the at the end of the roster, but that's another conversation. But as far as like the ability just to, I always think like, I would rather have the NBA players with this money to do for the community than the owners every day.
Even more than money, what we're talking about is power. And I define power as the ability to like make people do or influence people to do the things that you want them to do. So if you think about it, I do not have this in front of me. I mean, I can open up my phone very easily and find this out, but I would be willing to bank that LeBron James has probably quadruple the amount of Instagram followers of any NBA team. And so if you think about it, right, like as a whole team, you have this much influence. As one player, you have quadruple that amount of influence. And certainly if you look at sports and people in other sports, like you look like Cristiano Ronaldo, right? Like, I don't know how many, a quarter of a billion people or something following him. So like, just, I don't know if you're paying attention to what happened in New York last week, where a YouTuber told several thousand or told his fans to come to Union Square, and it ended up becoming a riot. But just like, think about that. Like a YouTuber who I don't know, maybe my son does, told people to come to Union Square and had thousands of people come to Union Square so hyped up that they eventually got into a brawl. So like that, to me, that's power. That's the power. And so it's exponentially more power, maybe not for the YouTuber, but exponentially more power than the average person that these now NBA players have. So they got money. Yeah, they can take care of themselves, but maybe even more than that, they can influence people to do these other things. And one of the things obviously they're doing is influencing people in what to wear and how to wear it, right? And how they style themselves. So for me, the power of it, and it's also power that can be quantified, right? Versus back in the day, like they used to do like polls and stuff about Jordan, but like, and you obviously, you know how many people are buying Jordans, but to be able to quantify one's influence every day to the exact number of people that have seen something or like something, that did not exist, and that is power.
Yeah, that point about power, like, even it's something I didn't start really thinking about till, you know, I played, like I rode the bench in high school, but yeah. I was in it, and then I got to college, and you know, I'm just walking around. I see, like, even when we take it back from, you know, people signing like multi-million dollar contracts being the NBA, but I look at the way that like fellow classmates, dorm mates would talk about, like, I just saw a walk on, because you can, you know, you're going to U of O, you know that people know which gear is like you buy from the duck store and which ones you get if you play.
You got the team shorts on.
But just like I saw that, you know, that status, that again, that power symbol, like where it's like someone who may have been like my peer in college, peer in high school, but kept playing and walked onto the team. People like, I saw someone in the commons. Oh my goodness. So like, dang, that's the kind of power this holds. That's the kind of influence this holds, even at that level. But it also,
Well, the thing about that is those guys had the power of being on the team and the influence of being on the team. They didn't have social media, and they also didn't have the NIL. So now you're getting college athletes who are becoming more well-resourced, and they also have the platforms, right? So it's a different world now. I mean, this really social media has created something obviously we've never seen before, but it's really kind of dispersed the power in a way that I think it's a good thing, but we've never had anything like it.
I mean, do you ever, when you see these NIL contracts, you see people, you know, like overtime, elite and all these things, like, do you ever just think, man, I wish I'd been up like 30 years later or something like
that. I'm glad that I came through when I did. My friend D Watkins, who works for Salon Magazine, just did a documentary. Wait, let me get the name of this because it is, let me see. It is called, We Were, hold on, I don't want to mess this up. D Watkins Basketball Doc. We Used to Win Here. And he's from Baltimore, and he talks about, you know, Carmelo Anthony and that kind of culture that built him up. But some of the guys he interviews talks about how the NIL has changed how players think about basketball. Like, now they're as concerned with marketing themselves, right, to get a big platform so that they can get these NIL deals. They're no longer going to the courts to play. Like, all the, when they went around, all the courts in Baltimore were empty because these guys don't even want to play outside anymore, right? God forbid you twist an ankle or something outside. So I recognize that it's empowered a lot of kids and giving people who didn't have the resources. But then I also see the negative of how it's changing. And also it feels, because it's so new, it's like the Wild Wild West out there. Like, there's no one with really any rules on this right now, right? And if you put capitalism with sports and there's no regulation, I mean, something is going to happen. I mean, remember when, you know, when in the 90s, everybody was getting in trouble for getting money from agents too early and stuff now, right? So, like, they're going to have to pull the reins on it. But right now it is empowering the younger people, right? And making them, basically, they're semi-pros, right? Actually, no, they're actually pros because they're getting paid.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's kind of wild because I remember back was when, you know, there was the whole thing about LeBron getting dunked on by a kid at like one of his camps, however many years ago that was. Yeah. And now it feels like any run anywhere is just filmed just in case.
Yeah. There's always a video camera. Yeah, that's true. I'm like, where was he? I feel like I could have gone straight to D1 if we had some cameras. So maybe that is a different thing. Like, if they was at Irv in the 1990s, I was playing against all the top talent. I think I could have made it.
I mean, I forget what his name is now, but the guy was just, he makes those clips of just like dunking on the mini hoop and just, you know, doing like the slow-mo with a bunch of people behind him. I'm just like, man, there were so many lanes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But kind of similar to that point, I feel like with basketball, with sports in general, even when, you know, our time is up, like, it's always something that kind of like just sticks, you know, like the lessons stay. I was curious with you, like, as far as any lessons, insights that kind of like translated from basketball into a writing career, into a media career.
Yeah. Well, I think about a really good player, and I'm going to take Kyrie because I think he's the best. Kyrie and Steph are the best at this. If you watch them, what they're doing on the court is art. It's jazz. It's like putting one move with another move and reacting to a player. And it's very artful. And I think of sentence making in what I do the same way. It's like putting a thing with a thing, reacting to a thing that came before it. So in a very real way, like, and I didn't have handles like them. I definitely would have been in the league had I had some Kyrie handles, but I can see the ligatures, or the connections between how they do and what they do, and writing. And I think also, you know, in order to make it to the league, I remember the very first published piece that I had was in the Portland Tribune. It was when the Tribune first came out. I don't even know if it's still around. Is it?
Yeah. Portland Tribune is still around. Maybe a little downsized, but still there.
Okay, great. Yeah, so it was in the Portland Tribune, and it was called Almost Famous, and it was about three basketball players from my era around my neighborhood who I thought should have made it to the league and didn't. And those basketball players were Denmark Reed, who played with me at Jefferson, Antoine Stoudemire, who played at University of Oregon and was Damon's older cousin, and Orlando Williams, who was the Blazers play-by-play, or not play-by-play, post-game guy a little while ago, but was a star at Oregon, and he was a senior at Benson High School when I was there. So I interviewed those dudes and talked about, you know, why they hadn't made it, right? They were almost famous. And then I interviewed Damon as a secondary for that story. And I'll never forget, he said, man, the difference between me and the other dudes was I didn't have a backup plan. Either I was going to make it or I was going to make it. And if you caught me in 2000 when I first started to, when I entered graduate school, that was the kind of outlook that I had about a writing career. Like, I didn't have a backup plan. Like, I was going to make it writing or I wasn't going to make it. And so I think that kind of tenacity and that single-mindedness and that confidence, even if it's ridiculous, is necessary to navigate a space that, you know, not a lot of people make it in.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Orlando, because we used to go to the same gym for a while, so okay. Being the runs, and he was
killing people, wasn't he? That left hand jumper.
Mm-hmm. it was two things that struck me about him. One was the jumper, and then two, like, he was still, you know, because like this had to be like maybe 10 or more years ago, but also just like, you know, the post and pregame prep stuff, like,
yeah,
you
know, yeah,
all the stuff that, you know, I take seriously. Yeah, it's like, I take it seriously now, but it's like, you know, at that time when you're just kind of like, you're younger into it, you can just kind of like show up on the court and run. You're like,
nah, man, yeah, old gotta be like 51 now, maybe.
But on that point of writing, I think, you know, even since, because remember us kind of talking about Almost Famous, mm-hmm. when I first interviewed you about the Residue years,
yeah,
back when at the Scanner. And, you know, one of the things I've always appreciated is just like your willingness to give advice, guidance to writers coming up mm-hmm. in the city. And, you know, I think one of the, it's like just doing like freelancing all around, like, you know, you're mm-hmm. constantly making pivots, and you gave me some of the best advice I've gotten in my last big pivot moment, where you're just kind of telling me, you know, look at these spots as far as like moderating, hosting events, in terms mm-hmm. of like, this is, you know, if you're looking for like where some of these opportunities, where some of this money is. And turned out, that was a very, very salient, very salient advice.
I'm glad it worked out, man. Yeah.
But you just talk about like, why is it so important for you to, you know, just kind of like give that little leg up, that, you know, just some of these nuggets, this wisdom to young writers.
You know, man, when I was, I wasn't even trying to break through. I think when I was trying to learn the craft, I was just so hungry for mentorship. Like, I've actually tried to force people into mentoring me. John Edgar Wyman being the example, the greatest example of that. But I just think it's so hard, right? Like, if you think about the number of Black writers that we can name that have come through Oregon, the number of Black, of those writers who have had a national profile, it's not a big list. And when I was coming through, I didn't know any of them. So I think it's really important if you feel like you have some kind of wisdom or knowledge to share, that you're beholden to sharing it, right? And, you know, you'd be a sucker to keep it all to yourself, you know, then what are you scared of? And why are you not, like, for me, I mean, it's all the same project, right? Like, everything I write is for my people. So why would I spend all this time learning how to write and then have the objective of writing for my people and then come in contact with the people and not share the information. Like that would be, I'd be living a lie. And so I'm really, really, really invested in that and seeing, you know, especially if you're from Portland or have a Portland connection, man, everywhere I go, you mention Portland, I'm like, oh man, I went to school with such and such, or that was my cousin's cousin's cousin. Like I'm about as pro Portland as you can get for not having been there for 20 years now, full time.
Yeah, to that point about just like representing Portland everywhere you go and kind of giving that spotlight to Portland, because it's not, you know, there's pushback. It's people don't see, you know, there's no, don't see the scene. I get it for other reasons, but you know, it's doing, you're doing a lot of just great work as far as like getting respect for the city. And it did make me think about an interview you had, remember how many years ago it was now, but like I'm gonna say a big Hot 97 fan, but I do watch Ebro in the morning and whatnot. And it's actually like I'm generally like a fan of Peter Rosenberg, but it was like, I'm not sure if you remember this interview, because I feel like it's kind of like pressing you on being there. And I was like, and I was just thinking to myself, dang, this is a, again, just like when you think about the getting respect for Portland in real time, like that's something I thought about. But can you just talk about like handling those moments where it feels like, okay, I know you're like, you're no stranger to adversity, but but handling those moments where, you know, it's like someone is like, they don't, you know, they just like, they don't see you like that.
I think, I don't remember Rosenberg's specific questions, and I've now been on Hot twice. I went back for Survival, and I'm actually going back for this book too. And you know, I'll say that the reason that made it easier for me to go, especially that first time, was that me and Ebro are actually friends, friends from when he was in Portland on air at Jammin'. But I think, you know, those two cultures, like the hip hop and music culture and publishing culture, even though they're both in New York, they are different worlds and they seldom, if ever, cross. And so on the one hand, it's like Rosenberg lives in that other world and he has no reason to know me, to know anything about me. I'm not a best-selling, you know, Steven Spielberg type of author. So really, why am I there? You know, but it's strange because if I were a rapper with my same backstory, it would make perfect sense to him. You know, I think I got a little less of that. I remember having a better, I don't remember the exact interview, but I remember having a better feeling there the second time around. And hopefully when I go this time, you know, this is post Pulitzer and this is a book that, you know, is easier to talk about, right? Like if he's a Knick fan, I believe. So I think it'll be easier to talk about, but man, nobody really cares about writers. That's, you know, like the only people that really care about writers are people in publishing. And then everybody else is like, why should we care about you? As opposed to if you're a music star or you're a TV or film star, like we immediately care about you. And then it's like you work from we immediately care to we care less versus we don't give a about you to why should we care about you. I think it kind of works different ways, and I think that's can be attributed to, you know, how many people are still reading. You know, like authors don't have, generally they don't have these big, you know, charismatic personalities where they want all the attention. Nobody's following an author around, nobody's following Colson Whitehead around with paparazzi, and he's the biggest black writer, I would argue, in America. Him, Ta-Nehisi, Jesmyn Ward, and the Hannah Jones, like those are the biggest writers we got, and ain't no paparazzi cameras following them around. I should mention Ibram in that, Ibram X. Kendi in that too. So I think it's just the culture that does not value us as figures. They might, even if they value the work is separate from us as a figure. And in the other cultures, it's the work and the figure that are kind of never separated from each other.
Yeah, and I think it's really important, especially for young writers to hear, just for the reality of it, because I think
yeah.
finally getting into the space where, you know, partially just for the sake of marketing and like yeah. making the business work, you put yourself out there and people see that and think they have this perception of like, oh, you're this big star writer because they
yeah.
see all your stuff on social media.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the, I don't know, the ecosystem of attention is, it works differently, but also yeah. again, like when we're on these platforms and, you know, you get the chance to like push, not even like push back against that, but just like show, hey, this is why I'm here. This is yeah. what I'm adding to the conversation. Aren't you glad you got to listen?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It does a great way of like cutting
I think you have to, you gotta, and it's very hard, right? Because in that space, everybody's trying to get on and talk to them. It almost is like you gotta move them out of the space of thinking they're doing you a favor. And I don't necessarily know. Maybe they still think they're doing me a favor, but in my mind, right? Like at this point in my career, I don't think anyone's doing me a solid by letting me come on their show. I think I have something to say. I think I put the work in. I think my work has spoken for itself. And so I'm appreciative. It's not like I come in there like, you should put me on. But if you do put me on, it's not like you did me a solid, like, we shouldn't do this, but I'm just going to do it because I like you. So, but the other thing is, I think if you have to be able, for young writers especially, no, for all of us, be able to separate the writing, being a writer, from being an author. So right now, what we're doing, I'm an author, right? I'm talking about a book. I'm hawking a book. I'm going to be going on a book tour. All that's author stuff. It's not writing. I'm actually got two deadlines pressing on me right now. So when we get off of this, I got to find my right headspace and become a writer again. And that's a very difficult space to navigate because the author really has nothing to do with the writer. Right. Like I could be an author all day and I would never get any more work done. But then the writer, you can make a lot of stuff and no one ever gets behind it. You don't know how to talk about it. No one ever sees it. And so it's a balance that you have to strike. But I would be wary of a person who wanted to be an author more than they wanted to be a writer.
Salient advice. So, yeah. You know, before I let you go, speaking of author and the writer, mm-hmm. Just give you another chance to just again hawk the book again, talk about, yeah. You know, you just remind the people, Fly, the big book of basketball. When's it coming out again?
September 5th.
September 5th. Yeah. Yep. Mitchell S. Jackson, thank you so much again for taking the time and, you know, all the insights and everything.
Yeah, man, I'm always happy to talk to you, man. You know, Portland folk got to stick together.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and I will be in Portland on September, I think it's September 20. Don't let me mess this up. Hold on. I think it's, where did it go? On September 20th. Wednesday, September 20th, I'm at Powell, so. You know, I don't know when this is airing, but come through. Don't let me be in there. It'd be real bad for me to be the hometown guy at Powell's and have an empty room. So don't let me suffer that, please.
That's right. Portland, Powell, September 20th.
Yeah.
Mitchell's going to be in town. It's Fly, the big book of basketball.
That's yeah. right. If you coming, put on something.
Oh, yeah. Man, I feel that personally.
Yeah.
I have to step it up one time. But yeah, Mitchell, thank you again.
All right, bro. Have a good one.
You too. This has been the Bruce Poinsett Show. Again, you can catch us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on the Numbers FM 96.7. Or you can catch clips on youtube.com/Bruce Poinsett. If you want access to exclusive bonus coverage, you can go to patreon.com/Bruce Poinsett. And make sure to follow us on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheNumbersFM. That's numbers with a Z. Or on the Numbers Podcast Network on all podcasting platforms or thenumberspodcast.com. Again, that's numbers with a Z.